This is the sound of community leaders in Minneapolis, Minnesota, protesting just days after Officer Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd.
The millions and billions and trillions that we waste on the military and the police need to go to our communities. We need housing. We need education. We need healthcare.
Chauvin's deadly, malicious disregard for life amplified demands across the country for cities to fundamentally alter municipal budgets by reducing policing dollars and redirecting resources to serve and protect communities with a more robust safety net rather than more deadly police weaponry. And just how much do cities spend on police? Well, the Vera Institute compiled fiscal year 2020 budgets for America's 72 biggest cities, and the numbers were astonishing. Chicago spends 37% of the city budget on police. Arlington, Texas spends 44%. And in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a full 58% of the city budget is spent on policing. But these substantial public dollars do not account for the entire budget of police departments. They have another meaningful stream of revenue, police foundations. Now, according to the new Police Foundations report from The Color of Change, police foundations are private organizations that funnel corporate money into policing. And because the money is not part of the municipal budgets, it's difficult to track. According to this new Color of Change report, quote, no entity tracks such funding, which means there's no record of how much is distributed, which departments receive it, or what equipment they purchase. What is clear is that dozens of Fortune 500 corporations have given millions to police foundations, even as their public statements and aggressive marketing insist.
Let us be perfectly clear.
Black lives matter.
We, the National Football League, believe Black lives matter.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and on today's Takeaway, we explore the largely hidden world of corporate financing of police foundations. Please welcome Scott Roberts, Senior Director of Criminal Justice for Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization. Scott, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me back, Melissa.
So what are the key takeaways from your new Color of Change report on police foundations?
Well, as you said, you know, we looked at 23 police foundations in cities around the country. We found that police foundations have really proliferated in cities around the country. There are police foundations in that we could identify at least 300 cities around the country. I think the main takeaway is that police foundations serve a anti-democratic role in providing back channels for corporate interests to funnel money into police departments, that they not only increase secretly, basically increase the funding for police departments, but that money does influence the way that policing is done in cities around the country, you know, further undermining the democratic process and the public policy process. And as you said, this is money that is being contributed to police departments by corporations that have made, you know, bold statements calling for police reform, saying that Black Lives Matter, when in reality, their contributions to police foundations really don't align with those statements.
So I get what police departments get. They get resources. But what do the corporations get? Why do they even care about or want to give money to local police departments?
Well, I think they're getting influence. You know, we have spoken to dozens of the companies that are featured in our report. You know, we have been working on this report for over a year, and we've actually been holding it for quite a while because we've been reaching out to companies, educating them on where their money is actually going when they're giving to police foundations. Many of them in their public statements will emphasize the kind of charitable work that police foundations do. So many police foundations spend some portion of their budget on maybe youth programming, you know, police athletic leagues, things of that nature. And so some of the corporations believe that their money is going primarily to those things. What we found is that most of the money is being spent on equipment, often militarized equipment, things of that nature that support the everyday work of police departments. But we also heard from companies who were, you know, those who felt comfortable speaking really directly about their motivations, that this is about the bias in policing. You know, we had one large media company that's featured in the report tell us very directly that although they understood our concerns about police foundations, that they were very reluctant to remove themselves from the board of the police foundation, to end their contributions, because they did fear for the safety of their employees. Not that police would respond by attacking their employees, but that they believed that their contributions netted them a special relationship with the NYPD. And this is really goes to the fundamental issue with police foundations, right? That they allow the really wealthy corporations to influence what's happening with policing in our country and give them unfair advantage when it comes to public safety. Police departments have also kind of been shaped by these contributions. So one of the worst examples, in my opinion, is a trademark enforcement unit that was created at the NYPD through contributions from the New York City Police Foundation, specifically contributions from corporate interests that care a lot about trademarks, motion picture studios, professional sports leagues. And they founded a unit in the NYPD that went around harassing street vendors to the extent that it became scandalous and the unit had to be shut down. But it just goes to show how this money doesn't just support charities or even just indiscriminately funds police departments. It influences the tactics, the focuses and priorities of the police departments as well. And we think that should be happening through the public policy process, not through corporate influence.
So, you know, as I look at the report, there are companies from basically every sector, from real estate to finance to retail, security, fossil fuel, media and entertainment, tech, communications, professional sports, including the NFL, the NBA and the MLB. So this looks to me like it's a standard practice across sort of all of these corporations. But these are also big companies. I mean, both Costco and Target and Walmart are all on this list. Do they even really know that they're giving money? I mean, in such a big company, who's even aware of where these dollars are going?
That's a fantastic question, Melissa. That is one of the things that I think even surprised us a bit as we started to talk to companies. The extent to which a lot of companies aren't really paying attention to their charitable contributions. Some of them have really decentralized giving structures where, you know, for instance, you might be a partner at a major financial institution and you're just kind of given a lot of leeway in terms of how you spend supporting charities. And so there's that, you know, a lot of the companies have to track down, understand who was actually responsible for giving to these companies, get an answer internally from those people in terms of why they're giving, have a second conversation with us about it. So to an extent, no, they don't. These companies aren't tracking well where they're giving money. There's also the fact that many of them believe they are sponsoring, again, like I said, charity rather than spending on militarized equipment or increasing surveillance of communities of color. And so we had to share a lot of information to help folks realize, you know, where their money was going. Some of them said they've gone back and had conversations with foundations who, you know, based on what they've reported back to us, we don't think the foundations are really being transparent, even with the companies in terms of how they're spending the money. But some of them know exactly what they're getting. Police foundations, I say they're kind of like Confederate monuments because we have this idea that, you know, they've been around for a while. The New York City Police Foundation is 50 years old, but actually about 40% of police foundations have been founded since 2014. This is a direct reaction to the protests that started in the wake of the killing of Mike Brown and the uprising that happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and the calls to demilitarize police departments. If you look at a lot of the websites of these police foundations, they're very explicit that police departments are under attack, that their funding is under attack, when in fact, as you know, police department funding has been on the rise consistently for decades.
Last week, Coca-Cola did put some distance, stepped aside from the Atlanta Police Foundation's Board of Trustees. And presumably that's in part related to Coca-Cola being named in this report. I'm wondering if that was part of conversations that Color of Change had with Coca-Cola and sort of for companies that are going to make that choice, how you see what a choice like that means.
Yeah. So, yes, those we did have extensive conversations with Coca-Cola. As I said, we've had with dozens of these companies. We're hopeful that more companies will do as Coca-Cola has done and, you know, really look at our concerns. You know, what Coca-Cola did was they stepped down from the board of the Atlanta Police Foundation. which has really been one of the most controversial of the police foundations. This is where we really started. You know, a little over a year ago, we had not paid that much attention to police foundations either. But with the killing of Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta, what happened was the police department, after the officers were fired and charged, the officers of the Atlanta Police Department took a sick day, a blue flu, as they call it. The next day, the Atlanta Police Foundation gave them all $500 bonuses, which, you know, I think there's a really clear, to me, ethical question raised, right? When a private entity funded by corporate dollars can give bonuses to public workers who have, you know, the legitimate use of violence and the ability to take away people's freedom as their job, right? So, you know, it seems like undue influence to me. But, you know, there have been some controversies with the Atlanta Police Foundation. In addition, very recently, they pushed through a massive investment in what's called Cop City in Atlanta, which brought together Black Lives Matter activists and environmental activists as they're building a massive training facility in the Atlanta forest. It's going to be devastating ecologically. So there are some controversial issues recently with the Atlanta Police Foundation that I think have contributed. But in our conversations with Coca-Cola, we emphasize the same things we've been talking about here, that, you know, it's not just about giving to youth charities, that the Atlanta Police Foundation has funded Project Operation Shield, for instance, which made Atlanta the most surveilled city in the country. And so through those conversations, Coca-Cola communicated to us that they had heard our concerns and they were stepping down from the board of the Atlanta Police Foundation. And so, yeah, we're hopeful that other companies, as they educate themselves, as they go through what are often, you know, long processes to change or create new policies within many of these really large corporations. But yeah, we're hopeful that they'll follow suit with Coca-Cola and put some distance between themselves and really, really stop giving the money to these foundations, because, you know, that money is being spent in ways that undermine democracy and endanger Black lives.
Scott Roberts is Senior Director of Criminal Justice for Color of Change. Thanks for joining The Takeaway today.
Thank you, Melissa.
April 2016, police arrive at Hobgood Elementary School in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. They are there to arrest children. In the assistant principal's office, police demand that four girls be brought to them, a sixth grader, two fourth graders, and a third grader. When an officer handcuffed the sixth grade girl, she fell to her knees in fear. When they pulled a fourth grader from her bus and put her under arrest, she begged for her mother and threw up on the floor. The officers put a pigtailed eight-year-old in the back of a police cruiser and took her to juvenile detention. And the crime for which these children were arrested? When older boys had a fight on the school playground in the previous week, these girls failed to stop the fight. If you're enraged, then you are like many of us who first read this story in a shocking new investigation by ProPublica and Nashville Public Radio. For more on this, we're joined now by the reporter behind that story, Mariba Knight, senior reporter with Nashville Public Radio. Mariba, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
What is going on in Rutherford County, Tennessee?
Yeah, so you describe what happened on April 15th, 2016. These arrests took place in Rutherford County. Eventually, 11 children, all Black, would be arrested for watching this fight and not stepping in to stop it. Our story outlines that this county had been illegally arresting and jailing kids for years, all under the watch of Judge Donna Scott Davenport. She is the county's only elected juvenile court judge, and she oversees the jail, she oversees the courts, and up until this incident, she actually directed police on what she called our process, which basically every child arrested, even for a very minor crime like truancy, would be taken to juvenile detention and processed. So this is a pattern and practice that this county has been doing for years. Like I said, all under the watch of its one and only juvenile court judge. She has been there since the inception of the juvenile court.
I have to say I was absolutely stunned by this reporting. And in part, you're very clear in the piece that the police officers themselves, at least some of them, are deeply troubled even by their own practices in these moments. And I'm wondering how it is that the judge is empowered to behave in this way.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's so interesting about this story, right, is that you have people who are part of this and they're going, wait, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? This doesn't feel right. And then you have other people saying, well, I'm following orders. So it's a really amazing example of, you know, gut check. What is feeling right? What isn't? But how she's done this is that power has been consolidated. Like I said, oversees the court. She oversees the jail. She appointed the jailer who runs the detention facility. This is pretty rare that one person can oversee an entire juvenile justice system in a county. So she really answers to no one except the voters, and she's been reelected time after time since 2000.
What does she give as a reason for arresting third and fourth graders, not for participating in a fight even, which would already be outrageous, but for simply observing a fight?
Well, the breakdown comes kind of along the chain of command. So we learn in this story that it's a single school resource officer who says, we need to arrest all of these children. And her belief was, they need help and we need to get them in front of Judge Donna Davenport so that they can get help. So in one sense, it's not absolutely the call of the judge to arrest these children, but the policies and procedures and the attitude that she's put in place in her juvenile court ultimately led to this day. Her edicts and her directives to law enforcement, which is incredibly odd that she can direct law enforcement. Judges don't usually direct law enforcement, but she did. And we have memos of her directing law enforcement to arrest children and bring them to the jail. And so in that sense, her power is really consolidated, like I said, but also because she is the architect of this juvenile court, she has set the stage for how most people behave in it. And this incident in 2016 was what broke through the surface, but this has been going on for decades.
Okay, so are all children in this county equally vulnerable, or are there racial or economic differences between those who get arrested and those who do not?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I just want to say, first of all, that many children got sucked into this. Absolutely. One of the things that a federal judge found was illegal about this county's behavior was how they detained children through something they called the filter system. Essentially, when they got to the detention center, the detention center staff could decide, we will keep you if we think you are a true threat. Now, what a true threat was never outlined in the manual. It never said what that meant. So it was up to individual people in the detention center to decide, is this child a true threat? Now you can see how that could be really problematic, right? So yes, it caught all different kinds of children in its dragnet. But the fact is that anecdotally, lawyers say overwhelmingly children of color were overly represented. The other aspect of this that is really important to know is that juvenile court is sealed, right? The records are sealed. You can't get access to them because we want to protect children, right? But what happened in this county when that arrest of those 11 children was that a number of lawsuits were filed in federal court, a flurry of lawsuits, 7 in total, that kind of all touched this incident in one way or another. And what that did was crack the door open into this secretive court. And it allowed us to see what was going on. And when you look at those lawsuits, overwhelmingly Black and brown children.
Very little time, but is anyone being held accountable?
Not really. The judge is still in power. The jailer is still in power. She is up for re-election next year. It is very hard to remove a judge in Tennessee. Really, the only way to remove a judge is to vote them out. So it's up to the electorate. Are they going to vote for Judge Donna Scott Davenport or not?
What led you all to this story?
Yeah, this was a story that was kind of coming in dribs and drabs. I first moved to Nashville just a month before these arrests at Hobgood Elementary. And then I covered some of the lawsuits that were filed in the wake of these arrests. But like I said earlier, what is really remarkable is how many lawsuits were filed, 7 in total. And so really, I just started kind of following the breadcrumbs of those lawsuits and talking to the lawyers who were representing the children. And that's where you could really see this pattern and practice emerging. So I knew it was a massive story. I came to ProPublica to say, I need a year to do this. Can you give it to me? And they said, yes. So really it was the lawsuits that, like I said, cracked the door open into this usually very secretive court system.
I'm wondering, especially given the secretive nature of it, if you know anything about the long-term effects of these arrests, even for children who may not have had long-term juvenile detention incarceration, if, you know, if it's either in the lawsuits or if in speaking with the families, you've learned anything about the health effects, the psychological effects, the cultural effects, the educational effects.
Yes, we have talked to a number of families who have been subjected to this draconian system. It ranges from, in the case of EJ, the little girl who vomited on the floor, she was so scared to go to school. She had bad dreams, really worried that she might get picked up at any time by the police. That's something we heard over and over again. Like, am I going to get picked up today? In many of the lawsuits of the children that were arrested that day, there was money earmarked for counseling, which was really good. We also talked to another young man, Dylan Geertz, who was detained for 4 days illegally. He didn't get his lithium. He had been diagnosed as bipolar. When he was in detention, he didn't get any medicine. And after he was released, he was put on house arrest. And the following year, he tried to commit suicide 3 times. I talked to another young man, Quintarius Frazier, who was held in solitary confinement for weeks upon weeks. I sat there with him and his mother. His mom says he has a really hard time focusing. He needs stimulation at all times. Even just sitting with him for a couple hours, you could see he was restless. He was pulling at his hair. He was pacing. He talks to himself. And he told me, I still talk to myself because I did that for so long. So it runs the gamut, but it is absolutely ever present in these children.
Thank you so much for this reporting, especially as you point out that accountability here must come from the public. And so this is journalism at its best to let the public know so that the public can decide. I really appreciate you staying.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mariba Knight is a reporter with Nashville Public Radio. Mariba, thank you for joining.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes. Lead exposure. There's no safe level for kids or adults, but in children, the effects can be disastrous. According to the CDC, lead can cause damage to the brain and nervous system, delayed speech and development, emotional challenges, and underperformance in schools. Worldwide, nearly 1 in 3 children have dangerous blood lead levels, which is what makes this next story truly a bit of good news. 2 years ago, lead pipes in Newark, New Jersey, meant the city faced a water crisis on par with what happened in Flint, Michigan. But today, nearly all of the city's 22,000 lead pipes have been replaced with copper pipes. Now, initially, the project was expected to take 10 years to complete. But thanks to an aggressive city-county partnership, it was completed in record time. For more on this, I spoke with Karen Yee, a reporter covering New Jersey for WNYC. And Karen started by telling me a bit about the impetus for Newark's pipe replacement project.
a few years ago, Newark was in the news initially for having elevated lead levels in its schools. And then a year later, it turns out there was elevated lead levels in people's homes and the water coming out of the tap. And that sort of escalated when a group called the Natural Resources Defense Council threatened to sue and then sued the city over just its high lead levels in the water and the fact that the city, they felt the city wasn't doing enough to fix the problem. So fast forward to summer of 2019, the federal government steps in and they actually mandate that the city distribute bottled water to thousands of residents. And so this was a huge deal. I mean, Newark was in the national press time and time again. And so around this time is when the city was rolling out its program to replace these lead pipes, right? These are lead service lines that sort of snake underneath your home and pump water from the underground water main to individual homes and apartments. So they were replacing this, but we're moving pretty slowly. And that's when the county where they're in stepped up and said, hey, we want to expedite this. We're going to bond for you. Here's $120 million in bonded money. And that really set the ball rolling. I mean, they've been able to now replace almost every single lead service line in less than 3 years. And initially, at their pace, they were going to do this in 10 years.
Now, cities have crumbling infrastructure of all kinds. What in the world prompted the state to say this one was worth doing that bond for?
So I think it was a mixture of the public attention and the public pressure to do something, given the rising lead levels. I mean, no level of lead is safe, but at one point, Newark had four times the allowable federal level in coming out of the tap water. And so this is infrastructure that has been, you know, underground and in the city and old cities for a really long time. But when you combine that with a treatment plant that wasn't operating effectively and where the treatment wasn't working, so essentially you had this acidic water pumping through these pipes and corroding the pipes and like eating away. So that's why the lead was coming out. Something needed to be done. And so I think that's where the county saw the opportunity, said, let's be a model for other cities. Let's actually put money into this to get this done quickly so that we don't have, you know, this mostly affects children and pregnant women, right? Let's not have another generation have to go through this.
Well, remind us about the dangers of lead and the impact that it does, in fact, have on human health and particularly on children and infants.
Of course. So it affects the development of children in particular, and lead is a contaminant that sort of seeps into your bones. And it's also really dangerous for pregnant women and can cause miscarriages. And I'll say that, you know, the lead that you consume in water is probably at lower levels if you do consume it. I mean, most lead poisoning that we know of, you know, 4,000 kids are diagnosed with lead poisoning in New Jersey alone every year. Most of it comes from lead paint.
Which is on old buildings, right?
Right, on old buildings. It could also be lead dust. It could be in soil. So, like, it comes from older homes. That's how most people get sick. But, you know, having lead in the water is also very dangerous because that's something you consume every day, right? And if you actually boil water that has lead in it, it's actually worse for you.
Okay, so tell me, is this just a Newark problem, or is there reason to think that this kind of pipe problem, this kind of lead leakage problem, is happening in other cities?
This is happening all over the country. I mean, I think the EPA estimates that there's 10 million of these lead pipes across the country. You know, lead is very malleable and it was really cheap material. Everybody wanted to use it back in the day. And this is something that we just haven't as a country really invested money in. I think with what happened in Flint, Michigan, their water crisis, and then shortly thereafter followed by Newark's water crisis, it sort of has put this renewed attention on this problem in particular, because it's not something you see, right? We take water for granted. We can't see these old lead pipes underground. But the good thing moving forward is with Newark having done this project, Flint is almost done too after 5 years of replacing their pipes. You see other cities start to try and do this and start to try and put this as a priority. And even President Biden, you know, his infrastructure bill, we'll see how it works its way through Congress and how much money is actually set aside. I think at this point it's $15 billion, which is not what it will require to replace every single lead service line, but it's something, right? Like any money to help this problem goes a long way.
So does Newark now stand as a model, both for the speed and efficiency of getting it done and for the way that it was financed? Will other cities be kind of looking to this Newark model and to this bonding model as a way to replace this crumbling infrastructure, which you indicate is really everywhere?
I think so. I mean, even Newark's harshest critics, I mentioned the Natural Resources Defense Council that sued the city, you know, they're now touting Newark as a model city. I mean, I think the way Newark did it, a partnership between locals, county and state officials is the way forward. I mean, there was a lot of moving parts to this, right? In some cities, these lead service lines are actually privately owned. So the state had to okay Newark using public money on private property. That was the first thing. The city then had to pass an ordinance that allowed construction crews to just start excavating on people's properties without having to chase, in some cases, absentee landlords. You know, Newark is 3/4 of the residents of Newark are renters. So that saved a lot of time. And with so much money being provided by the county, they could basically just go block by block and get it all done at once instead of sort of doing piecemeal here and there. So that was efficient and effective. And then the fourth piece of this was that Newark turned this into a local jobs program and hired a lot of unemployed local residents. And so I think people are pointing to the way that the city did it as an effective and efficient way and that will in the long term be cost effective.
Last thing on this. So you started in that response by talking about even the city's fiercest critics, typically residents, are often among a city's fiercest critics, even as they love their city. And I'm wondering if residents on the ground are, again, sort of completely celebratory of this, or if there's any concern, distrust, and if there is, how that's being managed, you know, relative to communicating with residents.
So I think for residents, you know, visually seeing these construction crews, I mean, Newark has replaced 22,000 lead service lines. That is a big number. That's a lot of construction crews for the last 2.5 years. So visually seeing the work has helped. You know, they know the city is actually doing something. And I think that's part of the process of building back public trust after everything the city has been through. And I think they're going to get there. You know, I think residents are relieved that this is finally coming to a close and are relieved actually to be able to feel safe opening the tap and using the water to cook, using the water to drink, you know, that those little things that you do every day, right? So I think the process of building back public trust is going to take a while, but they're getting there.
Karen Yee is a reporter covering New Jersey for WNYC, and in this case, getting to tell a good news story, which is pretty great. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
1956, Lackawanna, New York. Like all Great Lakes cities was thriving. Jobs everywhere, money everywhere. Steel plants, railroads, grain mills, the docks. Everybody had a new car and a conch. Restaurants, bars, stores, everybody made money. The smell of fried fish, chicken.
That was Tony Award-winning, multi-hyphenate Ruben Santiago Hudson during a 2019 production of his one-man show, Lackawanna Blues. The play tells the story of Santiago Hudson's childhood and finds him embodying the many characters who populated his youth. Chief among his cast is Nanny, the woman who raised him. Santiago Hudson first performed the show in 2001, and in 2005, he adapted it to an HBO movie. Esapatha Murkison played the role of Nanny.
Wherever she at, you're gonna have to go through me to get to her. Now go on, knock me down. Go on. If that's the onlyest way you know how to do things, knock Nanny down, because I can handle it.
This fall, Santiago Hudson has brought the show to Broadway for the first time, part of an exciting slate of works by Black playwrights being produced this season. I had the pleasure of seeing him perform Lackawanna Blues recently, and by the end, I was sobbing, just an absolute crying mess under my mask. Apparently, that's a fairly typical reaction.
I'm hearing that I'm messing up a lot of masks. Well, at least I have my hanky with me.
The ability to do any work on stage at this point in the pandemic era carries a certain emotional weight. But I also wanted to find out how performing such a personal work has felt for Santiago Hudson.
on so many levels, it's hit me on so many levels, and it's hard to really explain. There's no one emotion or one effect or one feeling that I have. I mean, the joy and exhilaration of being in front of a live audience again is one thing. The joy of being a sociable human being again, where you can share space with other people and somewhat feel pretty comfortable because of the protocols that we have put in place at the Manhattan Theater Club and the Broadway, in Broadway in general. That's one thing. Then another thing is the visit with the things that make my life and make me comfortable and also remind me of what I had to go through and what my responsibility and accountability is now that I'm here at this point. You know, so it's so many different levels. And I try to avoid falling into or finding myself too captivated by any particular feeling, because I know my job as a storyteller is to invite you into a world that probably most people don't know, and to, I guess, share a reality about the multiplicity of ideas and thoughts and feelings of people of color and how universal we are, but yet how specific we are and how beautiful and magnificent we are, and yet how disdainful and angry and joyful and all those feelings that get robbed away from us as people of color when other people are telling our stories.
I want to build on that for a second in two different ways. But I have to say my first reaction as I left, beyond the crying, which we'll talk about in a bit, I said to my husband as we stood outside, I said, I feel like maybe this is what Tyler Perry thinks he's doing, but that Ruben Santiago Hudson does it with a love and respect and interiority that I don't think I've ever experienced before. And that ability not only to mimic all of these characters, but to become them, I guess it's the deep empathy. I'm wondering as you do that, I'm wondering literally about the emotional exhaustion of standing inside of so many persons in a relatively short period of time.
Well, the emotional exhaustion is one thing, but the physical exhaustion is another. When you're playing 3-4 characters in one scene, and physically recreating what I remember of their gait, what I remember of their sound, their tone, their rhythms, you know, so it's exhausting on all levels, but it also is incredibly empowering, because all of a sudden I give these people, once again, from my viewpoint as an 11-year-old boy, I give these people again worth. I give them a place that's their own. And just to talk a little bit about what you mentioned about what Tyler Perry might be doing, that's a complex conversation because, you know, Tyler Perry has revealed the impact and power of the African-American community's money, and if they want to support something. Where he and I part ways is I think there are many more stories and that he can share with many more storytellers. And I think that's a big problem. And this is another subject, but that's a big problem in our artistic community as African-American people and BIPOC people, is are we really empowering the village the way other communities empower their village, the way the Jewish community empowers their village and supports their stories and other artists like them, the way Asian people do the same. I mean, listen, I've been in this business 45 minutes, and without bragging, but just looking at the facts, I have been heralded in every aspect of what I do as a writer, director, and actor. But yet no one has ever said, what stories do you want to tell, Rube? They want to hire me for jobs. And, you know, you do this job or do that job. No one has just sat down and said, what's the most important thing you think that our community should hear and that you can clearly and most profoundly tell that story to us in the next decade? So we want you to sit down and we want to bust your brain wide open and your heart wide open and share. No one has ever come to me with that. You look in the paper today in any Variety or Hollywood Reporter, somebody's got a 3-picture deal. Ruben's Lackawanna Blues won more awards than anything that season, had more viewers than anything that season, never got a deal or multiple deal. My Jitney won Tony's. I didn't, you know, the state, August Wilson State didn't offer me another August Wilson play. You know, Lackawanna Blues was shut down in 2001 until the pandemic. I had to put it on the road myself, you know. So, and here it is, you know, 20 years later with this country in absolute turmoil, and it was absolutely, we're trying to rebuild now, as you know, as we all know, but, and they needed Nanny to say it's going to be okay again. So they needed this product, that this love letter that I owned, and I'm back. So, but we, the Tyler Perrys, the bigger people, not to pick on him, I think their mission, this is my opinion, should be to, how do we empower the village? Where is the village being built stronger? Not where is my empire being built stronger? Not in just hiring people and getting artists that you respect, that you think are very talented, that have vision and have a lot to say that's important to our community. I think Nanny is important to our community. I'm not going to run on this. I know we got short time. But that woman who is the rock and foundation of the African-American community that's never heralded, that's never celebrated, and people say, give them their flowers now. Well, here's your flowers, Nanny. Here's your flowers, Aunt Vi. Here's your flowers, Aunt Minnie. Here's your flowers, Big Mama. Here's your flowers, Mom Overton. You know, that's empowering our community, reminding us of the foundation that we stand on.
What you just said cut through something politically critical. You said they needed Nanny to come back and tell them it was all going to be okay.
Yeah. But think about it, Melissa. Think about it. Think about it in all these old movies and stuff. Who is the one that's hugging the little white child that's distraught? Who is the one that's coming in? And you know, they always just use that aspect of these Black women and be the comfort and be the wisdom, but they don't use that all the rest of that stuff. Where were their faults? Where did they fall short? And how did they build it back up? What about the other things? When that big Paul Bunyan, when that big John Henry, when that big iconic Black figure walks in and he needs that shoulder, and also he needs to advice and needs to be told what the hell to do. That's Mama.
I think you also just went to the core of the only discomfort I felt sitting in the audience, which is when you tell Nanny's story, you're telling a story I recognize as my Nana, who I just lost. I recognize nearly every single person you embodied, a particular love that is does not allow any foolishness, but also is without limits. But sometimes the laughter from non-Black people in the audience at particular moments, and moments that are funny, that have to be told in order to tell the full humanity of the story. Ooh, still, it kind of like would get me, and I just wanted to sometimes turn around and be like, shh, no, not you.
Yeah. You know, but the good thing about that, you know, I mean, sometimes it's difficult for me as well, particularly when I say something, and I'm using the colloquial language that I knew and things, you know, half-pressed head, can I grease your scalp? You know, things that are ours. We own that, just like the blues, just like jazz never existed before us. And their sayings and things that never existed before us, the way they're said, the rhythms, the style. And that's what's great about August Wilson's work in a sense. I mean, saying things like half pressed head or you my baby, or I ain't gonna say it no more, or listen to me good now. You know, and these are quotes that I've heard. This is not imagination. When Nanny went to get Mr. Taylor, the one-legged man with the tongue, you know, the little problem, when I traveled with her, I was carrying a pot for him to eat. And in that pot was chicken feet and dumplings. And so I'm not ashamed to say that's what we brought. And some people may say, ugh and oh, but if you go to France right now, to Paris and order chicken, the feet's going to be on it.
No, that just made me hungry. When you said it, I was like, oh, now yeah. I got to sit here another hour. And now that's what I want.
You think about them dumplings. And then she gave him a sweet potato to keep his hands warm. Now, where's that from? That's on in my house at Nanny's. She had sweet potatoes. We had a wood burning stove. Like we didn't have a pot belly. We had a wood burning in the kitchen because we were in Buffalo. We needed more heat. And she always had sweet potatoes sitting on the top, wrapped in aluminum foil or by themselves or in a flat pan. So if you wanted a quick dessert, a quick lift, you take and you split that sweet potato in 4 or 5 pieces, put a little butter on it, maybe a little sugar if you want, yeah, a little brown sugar. And that was your, you know, and you could take that, put it in your hand and keep your hands warm too before you eat it. So that's my culture. What I'm trying to do is share the incredible depth and beauty of our culture. And that yam goes all the way back to Africa. See, if you really look at the lineage of what I'm saying in that play about our journey, the African diaspora, the migration, you know, the forced migration, the snatching of the slavery, that's one thing. But that was a migration that we had no control of. But the other migration we had control of, but we brought all those other things with us. The way we sing, the way we dance, the way we court. I had my harmonica on stage. It's more than entertainment. It's enlightenment.
What is the most important story that you want to tell that you think audiences need to hear right now?
If I had my druthers, I would do probably a 5-part Harlem Renaissance. I mean, a huge epic. If they did Roots twice, that we were slaves twice in Roots and we got over that and the victory is ours today. But who has really hit the Harlem Renaissance other than just a 2-hour movie? Let's go through the intellectual aspect of it, the musical aspect of it, the sexual revolution that was taking place, the political revolution that was taking place, the religious fervor that was going on, the movements, the Garveyisms, the political stuff. That let's do five parts. Let's don't truncate it. So I've been offered to do, you know, 2 hours. And I just said, I'm not going to do it. My stubbornness. I'm not going to. I can't hardly get through Madam C.J. Walker. The real story opposed to that, what I saw, nothing against them. That's theirs. But the woman who wrote the book, she wasn't even happy, you know, because they didn't let her tell her story. So give me five parts. Let me get a host of writers, a host of historians, a host of dramaturgs, a host of five directors, you know, and every Black actor in Hollywood that wants to be a part of it. And let's do it and do it right. That's when we were kings and queens again. And that's important to me. And I don't know if in my lifetime I'll get it done, but, you know, I spoke to Lou Gossett and Whoopi and different people, and they want to get it done. But we're not empowering the village. Mm-hmm. We have the wherewithal to do it. We have studios. We have billionaires who are Black people. What happened is, like, even me, when we reach a certain level, the white establishments takes you and provide something for you financially and position wise. But you work with them. The Black folks, why am I not at OWN? Why am I not at Tyler Perry? Why am I not at Macro? Am I not visible? And this ain't no complaint, because mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking more at the end of my career. I'm looking mm-hmm. more at retirement now, and I'm empowering the young generation. I have mentees getting ready to take over this whole thing. That's going to be the next stars in the next 4 years. But we need to be supported. We need to be financed. We need to be there. There are white bullies out there that stop a lot of things I'm trying to do. I need one Black bully to stand with me and say, we ain't stopping this man. He wants to empower our village.
And your village is also complex. Being yes. both Black and Puerto Rican, being part of the Afro-Latinidad. Talk to me a bit about that particular intersection.
Well, you know, having that duality of cultures, which they also come down to a certain stream where it's the same culture. But there is a complete and specific delineation between those cultures. And then there's, like I say, a coming together. I am as proud of being Puerto Rican, Boricua, as I am of being Black. The thing is, I was raised in a Black rooming house with country people from the South. So that's my gait. That's my rhythm. That's my sound. But I love, you know, my father, Ruben Santiago, whose story I didn't tell in this play, was very, very loving in day to day with me growing up, to the point where when he's the one that went and got me from my mother's people, when my mother left me originally early. She left me with her family in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh. My father drove from Buffalo to Pittsburgh and pleaded his case and said, let his mother raise me, who was Nanny. They thought it was going to be his real mother, but it was he called Nanny Ma. And Nanny got me. And when my Black family found out I was with this woman who wasn't my mother, they had a conversation. And Nanny convinced them that she would send me to Pittsburgh with them in the summer and keep me in one place so I can get my education. My father, who wanted me to move with him, he moved next door to Nanny, 3 doors away, so he could see me every day. So he took me to Puerto Rico as a child, you know, a few times. I took him as he got older when I became successful. So my next project after Skeleton Crew is a Latin musical was really a play with a lot of music by a Mexican writer named Karen Zacarias. Destiny of Desire is the name of it. I'm starting to find my root, my way into the Latin culture, the multiplicity of that culture, because that's where you're talking Cuban, Mexican, Spanish, Portuguese. We're talking Brazil and you know, Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. So I'm trying to figure out, how do I build that now? You know, so it's beautiful, though, because, you know, when somebody asks me my favorite dish, you know, and it's a simple thing, but I love my rice and beans. You know, I can eat them every day. And my daughter's just like me, Lily. You know, she's an actor on the show La Brea on NBC, and you ask her favorite dish. Me and her said eat a plate of rice and beans every day if we could. That's that Puerto Rico in me.
Ruben Santiago Hudson, Tony Award-winning theater artist and writer, director, and star of Lackawanna Blues. Ruben, I just want to say, I want to see that five-part Harlem Renaissance piece. I want to live that, so I hope that you are able to make it.
Well, thank you. And I greatly appreciate this opportunity to speak with you and all the work that you're doing. I've been following you for a while, and I'm excited to see what you're doing in the future, and I appreciate it.
The
That's all we have for y'all today. And as we sign off, I want to express my grief and anger about the events recounted in the story we discussed earlier in the show from Nashville Public Radio and ProPublica. Even though it happened back in 2016, learning about the arrest of schoolgirls at Hobgood Elementary School in Tennessee has kept me up at night. I'm the mother of two Black daughters, and it's hard to face the realities of their vulnerabilities in systems that too often fail to see Black kids as kids. Now, we know many of you will want to know more, so we're going to post some further research and resources on our website. You'll find it along with the story at thetakeaway.org. And be sure to tune in tomorrow for a brand new segment called The Takeaway Deep Dive. I'm going to be joined by Dorian Warren of Community Change as we take a deep dive into the issue of political cruelty. And we'd love to hear from you on this topic. When you think about our national or local politics, are there moments of political cruelty that stand out to you? If so, call us and let us know more at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.